Welcome to The Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology and this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of The Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews informed and entertaining guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to anyone wondering where all this is taking us. And now, your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
From iRobot to Battlestar Galactica, audiences have been intrigued with the possibility of machines becoming human. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is one of the emerging technologies we are struggling to regulate wisely. But what about humans becoming machines? Or at least more machine-like. In today's episode, you'll be hearing from John Danaher, a lecturer in law at the National University of Ireland in Galway. He delves into philosophical issues of technology. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Danaher.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me to participate in this conversation.
Oh, most welcome. One way we can picture the direction many people feel we're heading with prosthetics, implants, nanotechnology, etc., is to recall the Borg of Star Trek Voyager. Jerry Ryan played Seven of Nine, a human but a former Borg drone, on the crew of the Voyager starship. I was wondering, John, if you could recap who the Borg were, or maybe I should say was, to introduce some of the trends that seem to be happening in the real world these days.
Yeah, sure. So just initially, my inner Star Trek geek feels the need to correct you on the fact that the Borg were in many different Star Trek series, not just Star Trek Voyager. But apart from that, the Borg were an alien species. Well, they weren't actually a species. They were an alien entity or enemy that were encountered by various members of the Star Trek universe with two distinctive features. The first was that they were literal cyborgs. That's hence where the name comes from. So they were organic entities fused with technology. So you might imagine humanoid life forms with robotic arms and robotic eyes and various wires and tubes sticking out of them. And the other thing that was distinctive about the Borg is that they were a collective organism or a superorganism, so that individual organic entities like human beings were incorporated into this collective organism, and they entered into this shared collective mind. So it suppressed their individual personalities and agencies. And then this superorganism went throughout the galaxy trying to assimilate more organic beings into its collective consciousness.
Something like the hive mentality, why Seven of Nine was called a drone, like a worker bee or something.
Yeah, the kind of analogy is very much with superorganisms and on Earth, like bee colonies or maybe termite and ant colonies. And in fact, that analogy was made more explicit in later series of Star Trek, where there was a queen of the Borg who sat atop this colony of organisms. Although some people disliked that because they said that sort of ruined what was really interesting about the Borg, such that they had no hierarchy and no kind of one entity sitting at the top.
Right. It was sort of a generalized, well, as you say, a collective mind. Well, a central concern seems to be that what we know as human, being human, is changing because of technology. So in what way do you see that happening, you know, like the Borg-likeness of humans changing or increasing, perhaps?
Yeah, so I think it's worth distinguishing between two things. So the Borg is a useful metaphor or tool for thinking about technology and the way into which technology is progressing and developing and the relationship of humans with technology. So when I talk about humans becoming Borg-like, I don't really mean that we'll end up like the Borg in Star Trek, but we're starting down a path that is pushing us somewhat in that direction. And I think there are probably two senses of Borg-likeness that are incipient in contemporary technological trends. One is that we are becoming cyborgs, that we are increasingly fusing our organic material with technology. We're doing that in a few different ways through various prosthetic devices, including now neural prosthetic devices, so that we're becoming Borg-like in that sense. And the other way in which we're becoming Borg-like is that there's increasing connectivity between human beings. And you could argue, and this is an argument that people have made, is that this is suppressing our individuality and we're becoming more homogeneous, we're becoming part of a collective entity that is somewhat akin to the collective mind in the Borg.
Mm-hmm. And it's really not a foreign idea in terms of social networks. Mark Zuckerberg has talked about that in his futuristic ponderings for Facebook, is that there could become an emergent quality, you might say, something that just develops out of this very much connected series of individuals who were individuals. So it's not really far afield. And so what I'm thinking of is that, you know, we see humans, what it means to be human, changing. And I know a lot of internet and society and the ethics of emerging technologies, they all deal with this as at least part of their agenda, is what does it mean for human society and so forth. And especially us as people, what does it mean for us to be human, or for when we look at the future of humankind, why is it so scary to think about it changing? It seems like radical ways.
Yeah, I think these kind of technological trends that are pushing us to fuse with technology and to connect more with one another, they can be good things, and there are many good qualities to them which are worth remembering in this conversation.
Absolutely, yeah.
But they seem scary in a couple of ways. One is, if you have any sort of conservative impulse at all and any feeling that the human is sacred and what it means to be a human has significant value attached to it, then the concept of what it means to be human, the idea of what it means to be human, seems to be becoming more nebulous. It's more difficult to grasp onto anything that is uniquely or distinctively human. You know, we think about certain capacities that we have, like the capacity for maybe directedness or rationality or problem solving. It seems now the more we learn about the animal world, we share a lot of these traits with animals, and the more advanced our technology and artificial intelligence becomes, then again, the less distinctive these properties seem to be. There's nothing really unique about humans. So the boundaries between the human and the non-human are breaking down. And that's concerning if you have this conservative impulse. And it's also concerning in another sense if we think about the way in which we might be heading toward this collective entity or collective consciousness, because it seems to suppress individuality and self-determination. And for better or worse, most of us living in the world today, we are living in the Western world, certainly, liberal democratic regimes which are founded upon some ideal of individuality and self-determination, and that in many ways the greatest good in society is trying to protect and cherish individuality and individual self-determination. And if connectivity is breaking down the boundaries of the individual, encouraging us to become more and more homogeneous, then maybe the kind of ethical foundation of liberal societies is also breaking down. So that's another reason why it would be scary.
Well, especially when you think about who's in control, because the more collective things are and the less individualism, it seems the more vulnerable we are to a negative or nefarious controlling of those things. If we give over our individual autonomy, you might say, then who is going to be in charge? But I think you're right in terms of you refer to it as conservative. I think of it more in terms of religious beliefs. If you are a creationist, for example, you feel like humans were created as they are, animals as they are, and so forth. And of course, our perception of who we are and who animals are and so forth is socially constructed to a large degree. But I think that has a lot to do with it, because if you think of us as having developed, it is kind of like, well, who we are right now, that's one way, but who were we eons ago, or even just a century ago? I teach history of psychology, and my students are often amazed at the barriers in front of women who were psychologists 100 years ago, that they really weren't considered fully human in an academic sense or a professional sense. And I like to think of, well, look at that right now. What is there that is akin to that right now? And I think that, of course, minorities are still not a full part. I certainly notice that in terms of guests that come my way. We're a pretty pale-faced group here. And it takes real effort to broaden that out. But also the animals you mentioned, like primates. I think that if we were to develop a broader view of what, who has rights, just as we now realize women have just as many rights as men, perhaps in the future we'll see that primates have rights if they're, you know, they're social, they shouldn't be in isolation, etc.
Yeah, and there is a movement now towards extending certain kinds of traditionally human rights to primates. And there was a famous case in New York State a couple of years ago about giving a primate kind of habeas corpus rights to challenge its imprisonment. Mm. So there is a movement there towards the non-human person, as it's called.
Right. Do you have any other thoughts on that, John, as before we move on to a different angle on this?
Yeah, so I think one way of thinking about this is that we're undergoing a kind of a Copernican shift in terms of who and what we think is valuable in society. So historically, the Copernican shift was moving us away from the notion that the Earth is at the center of the universe, and the, you know, scientific revolution underwent several further Copernican-like shifts, including the shift that you were alluding to with that discussion of creationism and evolution. But if you think about those scientific shifts, they still left intact the notion that it is the human that is fundamentally of value in society. And then this is the core of, like, Enlightenment, humanism, and liberalism, that the human is still what matters most. But now with these technological shifts and social changes, when we see that the category of the human is more contested and contestable, we may be undergoing a Copernican shift in terms of what we think is of ultimate value in the world.
That's very thought-provoking. And we're only halfway into the show. This is your host, Jane Karwoski. You're hearing from John Danaher, lecturer in law at the National University of Ireland. In the second half of today's episode of the Social Network Show, you'll hear more about the ethical challenges of emerging technologies, particularly some of what it means to be changing in terms of being human, and also what aspects of networking, surveillance, and big data might have leading this direction.
Questions? Comments? Reach out to us. Our email address is questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com or find us on Twitter @SocialNetShow.
The parent company of The Social Network Show is Social Network Intermedia, Inc., a full-service podcast production company. With SNI services, you can add the personal touch of audio to your communication with followers or customers. Set your blog or company website apart by letting your audience get to know you by hearing your voice. SNI provides coaching, recording, post-production, uploading, distribution, and promotion services so that all you need to think about is your message. To discuss the possibilities, email questions@thesocialnetworkstation.com. We're talking with John Danaher of the National University of Ireland, and you're listening to The Social Network Show. I'm your host, Dr. J. And John, I was wondering about, since we are The Social Network Show, what aspects of networking, surveillance, big data, and so on may be influencing this and leading to the creation of a more Borg-like society?
Yeah, so I suppose when you're focusing on networking technologies, what you're thinking about is the transition to a Borg-like society in that second sense that I mentioned earlier on, so towards the collective consciousness or the collective entity. And I suspect that the biggest trend nowadays that's encouraging that shift is the emergence and the rise of the Internet of Things, the notion that everything in the physical world can be tagged with or imbued with a device that connects it to the internet. That device will record information about that object or that person. It could be a human being as well. That's one of the key ideas here, that we can be part of the Internet of Things. In many ways, we already are with wearable technology like Fitbits, that they're recording information about us and linking that to the internet. So mm-hmm. they're collecting that information. That information is then being processed using various data mining algorithms, being mined for useful information, useful patterns. And then that information can be used in decision making and in carrying out actions, because we have an increasing number of technologies, automating technologies in the world as well, that can receive signals, communications from the internet, and cause actions in the world. So, you know, the self-driving cars and various other robotic devices are instances of this. And maybe a simple example would be something like an insulin pump, which is hooked up to a wireless network and mm-hmm. can be controlled, and the software on it updated in the cloud.
That's absolutely an issue. I interviewed Bo Woods from IamTheCavalry.org, and that was precisely the issue that occurred to him or a friend of his. I can't remember which, but just realizing that if this thing were hacked, it would be, you know, curtains. And there have been, of course, for public infrastructure, at least one case of control of the electrical grid, although it seems far-fetched to a lot of security researchers, but it can happen.
Yeah, so one thing I would say is that this might seem too much like Borg-likeness when we're talking about, you know, the thermostat in our house being controlled through mm-hmm. this Internet of Things. But we are moving towards Borg-likeness when it becomes ourselves, like our biology, or maybe even ultimately our minds that are being controlled by this thing. And I have some statistics here that are just maybe worth mentioning, or figures about the number of devices that are connected to the internet.
Okay.
From uh-huh. Cisco Systems in 2014, they estimated that there were 12.1 billion devices connected to the internet by April 2014. They expected it to rise to about 50 billion in 2020. They also estimated that there are about 1.5 trillion things, objects in the physical world, and they will imagine that by 2030, 2040, 99% of those objects will become part of the internet, part of this Internet of Things. So we're creating, in a sense, a neural network to
yeah.
control the entire world.
What do you think of the idea of the ability of that, as an example, to become self-organizing, or to cross that, you know, a tipping point where some kind of emergent, I don't know whether you'd call it a being or entity, but is that even a possibility, do you think?
Well, I think it's certainly possible that it will become an emergent entity of some kind, insofar as that, you know, complex organizations tend to have emergent patterns within them anyway. Political organizations, bureaucracies, people often talk about them having a life of their own.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe they're using that in a metaphorical sense, but I think it is true that institutions that we set up have their own kind of self-perpetuating logic, their own desire for survival and self self-creation and self-development. And again, there's no reason why that couldn't happen with this Internet of Things, that you would get emergent patterns and organizations within it that have some kind of self-perpetuating quality to them. Whether it would end up being a life form, or would it end up being maybe like a collective consciousness, I'm much more uncertain about those things. And there are many debates in philosophy of mind about whether it's even possible for a collective entity like that to have consciousness. I just don't know what the future holds in that respect, but I certainly don't doubt that there will be emergent patterns of organizations within this system.
Well, if we think about, you know, what is thought, in a sense, how do we think, how are we conscious? It really does. The basis of it is our neural activity, our biochemical reactions and so forth that are going on in our brain. Now, that would be an issue for people who feel that there is, you know, an a soul that is apart from the physical body. But I think that
how neural networks gives rise to consciousness is still mysterious to us. We don't know exactly how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
In principle, I'm a physicalist about the mind. I think the mind is ultimately just a set of physical patterns. So mm-hmm. I don't see any, in principle, reason why something else couldn't instantiate a mind like the global Internet of Things. But I don't know if we know enough to say which pattern exactly will give rise to that.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the, aside from the things that are connected with the Internet of Things, how, where the connection with humans, with ourselves is?
Well, I guess there are a number of connections with ourselves. One of the obvious ones is that the kind of data that's being collected about us is forming profiles of ourselves or records of ourselves online. And in many ways, they are quite intimately connected with us. Just to give maybe a trivial example, I don't, and this is true for a lot of people nowadays, my memory of my life is not particularly great. Mm-hmm. Events that happened in my life, I rely very much on data that has been collected about me or that I've uploaded myself into various online repositories to recall and prompt my internal memory to recall events that have happened to me, including conversations. So even before we had this conversation today, I would have to consult my external memory storage, my email mm-hmm. account, to figure out what we were supposed to talk about and who you were and what we agreed to and all that kind of thing.
So, right.
There is already this intimate connection between ourselves and this network. I don't know if that's exactly what you're alluding to.
Yes, yeah, that's getting at it, because there is Eternamy, I think it's called. It's a program that will continue to tweet and so forth after you're dead, because it builds up a profile of, you know, what you would say and so forth. And so if someone you cared for or enjoyed talking to has passed away, that you can right now continue to have conversations with them, which is an interesting development. But, in your articles on your website, your blog, which we'll link to our website, but Philosophical Disquisitions, you talk about the influence of risk-based thinking as a mechanism that is making our society more Borg-like. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I think it's important here. We've spoken about technological trends that are pushing us in the direction of mm-hmm. Borg-likeness, and I mean that literally in the technology, the internet, these physical devices. But there's also ideologies and political philosophies that are pushing us in that direction, and one of them is arguably the emergence and domination of risk-based thinking in modern societies. So the idea here is that lots of things in the world pose risks to us, to our interests, to things that we value. And really the job of modern government and commercial enterprise as well is to manage those risks, mm-hmm. prevent those risks from materializing. And these risks, that includes everything from terrorism and various national security risks to public health crises like obesity or cancer or infectious disease epidemics or natural disasters, environmental disasters. All of these things are risky. They present opportunities for risk, and we must manage them in some way. And the technology, the global Internet of Things, this connected neural network, it provides us with an architecture for controlling and managing those risks, possibly. So, one thing we might be worried about is the excessive use of heating oil or the burning of carbon fuels in our homes, and smart thermostats, which can be controlled centrally, are a way of controlling the risk that they pose to us. I mean, that's, a simple example of, mm-hmm. of the phenomenon.
Right.
But yeah, the emergence of this risk-based mentality and risk-based thinking is one of the ideological impetuses for creating a collective system of control.
So because we want to be ultra safe and diminish the chance of negative things happening, we're willing to have a ton of data collected and eliminate some of our personal control over that data. Is that the idea?
Yeah, and I mean, there are ways in which this is very explicitly articulated. So I don't know how familiar you are with the idea of the nudge thinking. This is a book written by two Chicago-based academics a few years ago, Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler.
Tell us about that.
He has a philosophy called libertarian paternalism. It's based on this notion that people aren't actually very good at knowing what's in their interests or acting in their long-term interests. And we should set up systems in society that default them towards what's in their interests in the knowledge that they're unlikely to deviate from those defaults. So we allow them to have the choice of deviating from those defaults. So it's libertarian in that sense. But we know they will probably won't, and they'll stick to it with doing what we deem to be ultimately in their interests. That's the paternalistic side of it.
Well, it's also the idea of making it easy for people to do what is right.
Yeah.
But the who decides what is right, I guess, is the paternalistic part.
Yeah, and I mean, there's probably very good intentions behind all of these things, and I'm not really trying to commentate on it in a negative way. I mean, one of the famous examples of this nudge ethos in practice was people paying in contributions to their pensions, and it was observed that people aren't very good at doing that because they don't really plan for their long-term future very well. They're not very rational about it. So the default in every company should be that everyone's automatically paying in 3%, and these payments automatically increase after a number of years, and that's ultimately in their long-term interests. But if we didn't set the default in that way, they wouldn't do it. So there's kind of benign and positive intentions behind it, but it's an example of how we hand over control to a default control system.
Yeah, look at the opposition there has been in making privacy settings more strict by default, or for parents and so forth to protect their kids. It's remarkable to me that people would consider it terribly offensive to have to click a button to undo those privacy buttons, but save privacy settings. But I personally would be in favor of that. You've done a lot of your writing on the website IEET.org, which stands for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And I must recommend that as a marvelous central point from which to explore the questions that we've been talking about. How long have you been involved with that?
I've probably been involved for maybe 2 years, 3 years, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was probably late 2013 that I came on board. So it's probably just over 2 years now.
What other organizations do you find that really feel like home to you in this part of your scholarship?
Oh, IET is probably one of the main ones. There's the Institute for Ethics, or the, I can't remember the pronunciation of it, the Ohiro Institute for Ethics in Oxford, and the Oxford Oxford Internet Institute, which are two academic fora that I'm cover topics that I'm very interested in. The IET is more of a think tank and a transhumanist type organization favoring a transhumanist philosophy. Similar organizations would be Humanity Plus and also, I guess, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which looks more at the risks posed by artificial intelligence. And they're all easily locatable online, and they have lots of good discussion papers and materials available to people if they're interested in these topics.
Great. Well, thank you. I think when, thinking back to the question of the risk, risk perception to me always includes how likely is X to happen and how serious is it? So if people think something is very likely to happen, but not terribly serious or disastrous, they may not be that engaged in preventing it. But our society seems to be more and more concerned about any kind of risk, anything going wrong. And instead of thinking, well, if it's not going to cause that much trouble, do we really have to be concerned about it? Or if there's only a few people affected, and I think that's a really, we've gotten to the point where there's zero tolerance for risk. Do you think that's a factor in what we were discussing earlier?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the the trade-off between the likelihood and the magnitude of the risk is a big factor, and also just this increasing tolerance for less and less risk in our societies. I mean, one example of this, which might resonate with listeners, is the way in which parenting has changed.
Mm-hmm.
The whole debate around freestyle parenting, which I believe is probably more of a debate in the US than it is in other countries. But parents are increasingly intolerant of exposing their children to any risks, including things like, you know, riding the bus on their own or riding the subway on their own, mm-hmm. when historically these things are very common. And you, mm-hmm. you wouldn't be deemed to be a negligent parent and your children wouldn't be taken away from you by social services because you left them alone for an hour in a park or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is that example of this less tolerance for risk, which again creates this ideological impetus for better control systems. And that's right. One of the things that technology might promise us.
Well, and in thinking of this added dimension of life that the internet has added to, especially like parenting, you know, it was tough to be a good parent before, and now we've got this entire new dimension of life, which is traditionally, historically, was inhabited by trolls and bizarre people who enjoyed just seeing if they could do it, just to see if they could do it type of thing. So there's a lot of factors involved. Well, thank you so much for being with us on this edition of the Social Network Show. I find these ideas very intriguing. Thanks for sharing them.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure to talk with you.
And to our listeners, if you listen via iTunes, please leave us a review. That would be great. And in addition to visiting our website, thesocialnetworkstation.com, you can get a great overview of our shows on the Social Network Show channel of audioboom.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow, as well as hear the show on Rabbit TV and others where you can enjoy the programs, the episodes as they come out, usually every Monday. And we have also created an app for the show for iOS and Android. So until we meet you here again, please have fun and be safe online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the worldwide show dedicated to social media networking and understanding the connected, networked world we live in. Listen to our archive shows on thesocialnetworkshow.com and follow us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia Incorporated. The views and opinions expressed are those of our host and guest and may not be the views and opinions of Social Network Intermedia.